Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, your host for Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. And I'm here this week with my co-host, Greg Tyler.
Haven't we done this before, Mark Morrell?
We can't do it enough.
We can't do it enough. You know, I have to tell you, I must confess to our listeners and fellow fans, today was a bit of a drainer at the office, at the day job. I love my job. I'm very, you know, glad to have it. But it was just one of those days. And I was thinking in the hours and minutes leading up to our recording session tonight, gosh, I just don't know if I have it in me. But you know what? As soon as we started recording and I heard Mark Morrell's amazing, "Welcome, Voltron fans," I was back in the groove. So it is wonderful to be here with you, Mark, and of course with our listeners and fellow Voltron fans.
Yeah, and after having two really great interviews with people that work on Voltron Legendary Defender, we had Bex Taylor-Klaus, and then we had Benjamin Kaltenecker.
Mm-hmm.
I really am excited about getting back into these episode reviews.
You know, I kind of forgot we even did those. I'm kidding, of course. Yeah, it's been a while since we did Shiro's Escape, and we're here to talk about the next one, which is Greening the Cube.
Yeah, so every time we do one of these episode reviews, I'm so stoked because I look at these episode reviews as a chance to really go deeper into what is going on in each of these episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I try to think of things that really stand out in each episode that we can talk about while we're, you know, reviewing these episodes and everything. It's not just about going through the script. It's not just about, you know, what happens, what the plot lines are and stuff like that. But I notice a lot of things that each time that I watch these episodes, I notice more and more each time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the details of, you know, the art and the animation and just lighting and shading and all this kind of stuff and perspective. And it just, it amazes me how well these shows are. And the music.
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
You know, yes. just there's all these little aspects that make this show so special, and it might be a little thing that they did that's anime-like or something like that with one of the characters, or it may be a sound effect or something like that. It's just, there's a lot of little things that really make these shows special.
Yeah, and as an example, on Twitter within the last several days, I was re-watching Space Mall. And I noticed in the shop at the Space Mall where the alien is, the gray with the Area 51 cap, the shop is called Terra. Inside the store, you see the front end of a DeLorean.
Right.
From behind the shop window. I had not noticed that before. And there's also a toilet mounted on the wall right next to the DeLorean. I don't know if there's any kind of hidden meaning there, but
did you get validation from somebody about that?
Yes, I actually tweeted and asked, "Is that a DeLorean?" And Christine Bean replied and said, "Good eye." And so, yeah. Yeah. Now, it looks like they tweaked just enough details, you know, to avoid the stuff that can happen when designs are used verbatim. But it is recognizable as being very, very heavily inspired by an authentic 1980s DeLorean. It's beautiful. And I got to tell you, the toilet's pretty awesome, too.
I wonder how many people, after listening to our last episode with Benjamin Kaltenecker, went back and looked at Space Mall to see if they could find the B-Jammin' symbol on Kaltenecker.
And that's why I was watching that episode recently, was to you know, refresh my memories on that particular scene. And it was just neat to see some stuff. There's a whole lot of stuff hiding in that store. And unfortunately, with the window glare, you know, you're looking through the front entrance and the shop windows. You don't get a lot of detail of some of the items in there. But I would love to dissect that shot, that wide shot, and try to figure out what some of those little knickknacks are. I noticed some symbols that are, I believe, associated with the Illuminati. There's some really neat stuff in there. And even the shop display where the Mercury Game Flux 2 game system boxes are stacked up.
Yeah.
It looks a lot like a vintage, like a 1970s or 80s vintage grocery store display where you might have like meat products or something like that, you know?
Wow.
It's really, really cool. Like, you know, you might walk in the meat section and see, you know, all the bags of frozen chicken or whatever. They've got, you know, other knickknacks in there instead. But there's some great stuff there. And that's just one example of the many things you can notice when you watch a Voltron Legendary Defender episode multiple times.
Yeah. So now we get to talk about greening the cube. So this is episode 4 of season 2, and it was written by Lars Kensith and directed by Eugene Lee.
Yep, and the I'll just run through the cast and additional voices if you don't mind, just to shake things up a bit. The cast is pretty well known to our listeners by now, of course. Kimberly Brooks, Rhys Darby, Josh Keaton, Tyler Labine, Jeremy Shada, Bex Taylor-Klaus, and of course Steven Yeun. The additional voices in this episode are Ike Amadi, Mindy Sterling, and
Fred Tatasciore. Yeah, Fred Tatasciore is. He plays Lubos, and he is a hugely prolific voice actor who's not only known for animation and video games, but when there's CGI characters in some of the major motion pictures, Fred's there too. He was Goldar in the Power Rangers movie.
Really?
He
Wow.
was in the Angry Birds movie. He was in Star Wars: The Force Awakens. He was in Family Guy, American Dad, Robot Chicken, tons of DC Comics series and video games. Basically, if you name a character, he's probably played them somewhere.
All right. Well, Fred, you've just been massively promoted on our
You know,
podcast.
I've interviewed a lot of voice actors through Toon Barn and obviously through the Let's Voltron podcast. But Fred Tatasciore is one of those voice actors I haven't had a chance to interview yet. And I just can't wait to do that.
Oh, that'll be great. So, yeah.
You know, one of the other ones you mentioned was Mindy Sterling, who plays Reiner. She's one of those actors who's also been in literally everything. She has tons of acting credits, but she's still remembered well as Frau Farbissina in the Austin Powers movies.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
And also, she was in How the Grinch Stole Christmas. She's also been in Robot Chicken. Robot Chicken gets everybody.
Oh, yeah.
She was in Reno 911, Desperate Housewives, and she played Lin Beifong in The Legend of Korra.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And she's also in the upcoming Batman and Harley Quinn movie that's going to be debuted at San Diego Comic-Con.
Wow. I have to tell you, I love that she has a very rich vocal quality that I absolutely love in her delivery of Reiner in this episode.
Like she's a teacher that you had in fourth grade or something like that.
Yeah, your favorite teacher that you had in fourth grade. Seriously, I absolutely love that vocal quality that she brings to the character.
And then Ike Amadi, who plays the Galra commander on Olkarion, he's a video game and TV actor who currently plays Angor Rot on Trollhunters.
Oh, cool.
And he has many video games to his credit, including Call of Duty, Advanced Warfare, Quantum of Solace, and Halo 5 Guardians.
Wow, we've got some great voice talent, both of course in the regular cast and with these additional voices in this episode.
That's right. So, you know, normally we had put those additional voices in at the end because that's what they do in the credits. But these people are really, you know, some of the best voice actors out there that you're going to see that could be guests on this show. So I'm so glad that, you know, Voltron Legendary Defender has that kind of status that it can bring in the top talent, you know, for the additional voices that are needed on all these different episodes.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so let's get started on this episode.
Okay.
As we start, the Paladins are in space. They're repairing the Castle of Lions. All five paladins are in their uniforms, floating around a blue coiled unit on the outside of the castle ship. But before that, you know, while the ship is just being shown, we hear Shiro off screen saying, "Let's hurry up with these repairs. Zarkon could be here any moment."
I have to say that I don't want to break this early, sorry, but it's neat to see the Paladins, these seasoned people who fly in space all the time, actually in space themselves. That's kind of a neat twist. That's all.
Yeah, so this is nice. You know, at the beginning of every Star Wars episode, it always starts out in space, right? After you see that opening crawl.
Except in Rogue One, of course, but it did start in space.
Well, I'm talking about the episode movie, Star Wars episodes 1 through 8, you know, I guess we're up to now.
Or we will be very soon, yes.
Yeah. But yeah, they always started out in space. So this is cool. Shiro is talking about the repairs. Zarkon could be here any moment. They still have to worry about Zarkon. And then Hunk says, "Okay, panels off, now what?" So then we see the scene switch to the castle of Lionsbridge, where Karan and Allura are. And Karan says, "Very simple, just loosen the Blacksums on the Soma flange."
I got nothing.
Of course, we have to, when we do these reviews, you have to look at the subtitles on these to be able to see how they spell these things, because some of these things we've never heard of before.
Yeah.
Blacksums and Soma flange.
Yeah, I'm still embarrassed that I misspelled quintessence for the longest time in social media before I actually watched the daggone subtitles. But, oh well, yes, we have to watch those.
Of course, we're talking about things we've never heard of before, and of course, Karan is the one that mentions it first.
Mm-hmm.
So, just loosen the Blacksums on the Soma flange. And then Hunk looks, "Could you be more specific?" And Allura says, "Sorry, Hunk, he means the Poklones on the Agroclams."
Now, okay, I love this fictitious stuff, okay? I think Star Trek has sort of introduced me to all that with all the subspace what's-its and the warp cores and the inertial dampers and all that other crazy technobabble stuff. I love reading this stuff and hearing this stuff. It's just fun. Anyway.
And the control panel's in Altaian. So my question here is there some reason Karan or Allura couldn't have been out there for this?
That's a wonderful question. And why does it take five people to do it?
You take everybody who doesn't know Altaian and you put them out there to do something that's only written in Altaian.
I'm thinking the mice would have been better qualified at this point. You know, I mean, they actually fixed the particle barrier in The Rise of Voltron based on mental commands. And of course, they helped get rid of the Galra presence when the castle had been taken over by Sendak, you know. So,
oh, yeah.
Those mice are no slouches for Altaian technology. Maybe they would have been better suited for this.
Yeah, I think they're pretty good readers, too.
Yeah.
So Hunk says, "No, that doesn't help." And then Lance pushes Hunk out of the way and says, "Easy, Hunk, I got this." And of course, Lance is operating the controls randomly, as he usually does when he doesn't know what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, all of a sudden, there's whirring, alarm blaring, and then the panel and the hexagonal pattern on the main hull goes red.
Yeah, so this is actually interesting. We're seeing a very tight close-up of the hull of the castle, the main hull. I mean, you know, we all know by now the castle in its ship configuration. It's got this big main hull and then these four articulated struts. And then at the end of each of the struts is a tower or a nacelle or whatever. So we've got this tight close-up on the main hull, and there's this hexagonal pattern on the hull, which you normally don't see. The camera's so far away. But here, you not only see it, but that pattern glows red, which can only mean bad things.
We do see that same kind of a pattern when they have the barrier up.
Yeah, so it makes me wonder if maybe that barrier is projected from this hexagonal grid on the hull.
It could be.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not?
Mm-hmm. We need, in addition to an Art of Voltron Legendary Defender, I really want a Voltron Legendary Defender tech manual. So let's all get on that, guys.
Okay, so Lance says, "Uh-oh, that can't be good." So we're on the bridge again, and Allura says, "No, not the Smalters, the Poklones." And Karan says, no, it's the Blacksums." So we're back out to space again. Keith says, "What are you talking about?" So Pidge floats over and examines the panel. Her eyes dart over the controls. With understanding and even a bit of flair, she operates the proper controls. The alarm switches off, and the hexagonal pattern in the hull stops glowing. And then Pidge says, "There, fixed."
And this shows that Pidge is beginning to get all this. Not just the tech, but the Altaian text.
Yes. And Allura, over the voiceover, says, "Well done, Pidge." Pidge's eyes become like plus signs. And she's holding her hands in fists together as sparkles form around her as she says, "The tech on this ship never ceases to amaze me. It's so mathematically elegant. Its fit is 100 times more frictionless than any exoskeleton we have on Earth." So they show the whole ship view as she's saying that.
Mm-hmm.
She says, "It's beautiful." And then Lance says, "It's not a sunset, Pidge." And of course, you remember how Beck said Lance can rub Pidge the wrong way?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is one of those times.
Yeah.
So Pidge admits, you're right, a billion sunsets just happen every day. But some genius engineer actually built this.
Yeah, I love this thing. This exchange here, it's just one of those moments that just sells Pidge's character so well. I really like this bit.
And Hunk, as the thing is closing down, Hunk says, kind of looks like a big, delicious curly fry. So I didn't see it as that, and maybe it's just because I wasn't as hungry as Hunk was at that moment. But I didn't see it as a curly fry.
The panel has this kind of coiled pedestal with the control panel on top, and the coiled pedestal was glowing blue when everything was great, and it glowed red when Lance started screwing around with the controls. And so I guess that might be a curly fry. I don't know.
And the best place for curly fries is Arby's.
Okay.
Have you been to Arby's?
Not lately. It's been a long time.
Okay, well, they have the best curly fries, in my opinion.
Well, I will take your word for it. I've been a frequent visitor of Burger King for obvious reasons.
And, of course, we had said before, we don't do ads on this podcast.
Right.
Arby's has the meats.
Nice.
Okay. Hunk says, kind of looks like a big, delicious curly fry. And all of a sudden, a potato-sized glowing blob hits the left side of Hunk's helmet and visor.
Mm-hmm.
And he groans and says, what the? And a large view shows the ship is entering a field of what looks like floating snowballs.
Right.
So Shiro deploys his personal shield on his right forearm and then calmly says, all right, we're prepared for this. The blobs begin to impact Shiro's shield, and Keith deploys his shield. And Shiro says, remember your rogue projectile cluster training from the garrison. He says, first we need a temporary shelter. And a blob hits Shiro in the back of the head. And he seems surprised, and he says, what? And then Lance says, oh, sorry, Shiro, I was trying to hit Keith. And then a blob hits Lance square in his visor.
That's some amazing training they got at the garrison, isn't it?
Your rogue projectile cluster training.
That's right.
So Lance growls, you know, because he didn't like the fact that he got hit. And then Keith chuckles and says, you mean like that? And then Hunk floats into view with a blob in each hand. By the way, if you're taking screenshots, that part where Keith says like that, that's a perfect screenshot that shows both Keith and Shiro have the same smirk and smile.
Nice.
So Hunk floats into view with a blob in each hand, and he's like, yes, squishy asteroid fight. So Lance, Keith, and Hunk begin a snowball fight in space.
Awesome.
So they haven't had this much fun since the food fight.
Yeah, it has been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah. So they're all grunting and yelling. And here's the thing about this whole scene that is surprising, okay? It's done in a totally different style than what you see usually.
Uh-huh.
You would think there would be some heavy action going on here. But the way they did it, it's like floating images of each paladin with snowballs splatted against them, where it's like a snapshot image, but the image floats across like it is an action shot.
That is cool.
Did you see how they did that?
Well, I noticed the montage of stills, but I didn't really notice. I just don't recall off the top of my head that the moving still shots. That's a really cool effect.
Yeah, and it's not like it's characters moving in slow motion either. It's just these frozen images moving like almost like an animated comic book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really cool the way they did that.
That is neat.
So Shiro off screen says, all right, guys. And then he joins in and he says, oh, okay, now it's on. So as this is going on, Pidge is studying a passing blob, then takes it in her hand and examines it up close. Lance off screen says, oh, come on. And then Pidge says, I don't think these are asteroids. And then Pidge says, Karan, I'm going to need a containment unit. So on the bridge, Karan is saying, just a tick.
And we now know how long a tick is. If you go to our YouTube channel, there's a short video about that. So anyway, sorry, I had to plug our YouTube channel.
That's okay. What exactly is a tick? Greg made this video and we find out that it's actually
1.4 seconds.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We now return to our review.
We are going to have another measurement of time later on in the program that we're going to have to go over as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Alora says they appear to be some sort of hyper-resilient spore. So now we're back to Pidge's point of view as she examines the blob in her hand. So Pidge says, this bioluminescent pulsing doesn't seem natural. A sphere-shaped containment unit flies to Pidge's position, and she puts the blob inside. Pidge says, it appears programmed. I think it's a code. Hunk stops taking part in the snowball fight, and he says, a code? From who? And then, of course, a blob hits Hunk in the face as he's distracted, and he grunts. And Pidge says, I don't know. I mean, it makes no sense. You can't program a spore. So now Shiro has stopped playing around, and the spore is contained in the containment unit. Shiro says, if anyone can figure it out, it's you, Pidge. And then a blob hits Shiro on the right side of his head, and he sort of floats on his side. And then we see a wide shot of the Castle of Lions flying through the spore field. And then Alora on the voiceover says, before that, everyone needs to come in for decontamination. So we see the paladins in uniforms covered in spore snowballs standing in a decontamination room. The room lights are red. So the paladins are being showered in the decontamination room. And then Hunk's saying, ah, and Pidge is yelping. The room lights are no longer red, and it changed to a different scene, still in the decontamination room, but it looks like it's a different step of the decontamination.
Mm-hmm.
Suds are up to their waists or higher. Shiro and Hunk seem to be enjoying themselves scrubbing their suits of armor. Pidge and Lance look uncomfortable. Keith stands arms crossed as if sulking.
And I can just hear Pidge saying, I'm so emo.
So Hunk is laughing, Lance is growling. Now the decontamination room is completely filled with what appears to be water. And Keith's arms remain folded. Lance is on his back, legs crossed, relaxing. No one else seems comfortable. A right-to-left stream of high-pressure air is now blow-drying the paladins. Keith's arms are still folded. Hunk is standing still, smiling. Lance is hiding behind Hunk, trying to avoid the air. Shiro is standing still, helmet off, his white tuft of his hair blowing to the side. Pidge has her hands on her helmet, with teeth clenched and eyes squeezed shut. And then the air finally blows Pidge off screen. So, lights above and around the decontamination room door switch from glowing red to glowing green. I guess that means they're all decontaminated.
Yes, and it's good to know that red is the universal color of bad things, and green is the universal color of good things.
Yeah, yeah, like a stoplight.
Yep.
So this dissolves to Keith sitting in his cabin on his bunk. He's wearing his regular outfit. His jacket is lying to his right. He's holding a knife in his left hand, and he's looking at it intently, and he can see a reflecting image of himself in it. So, just below the base of the blade, a purple alien glyph glows.
That sounds rather ominous.
So, he hears footsteps approaching and a door beeping, and he quickly slips the knife under his pillow. So, the door to his cabin slides open, and Karand is standing on the other side with a small scanning device in his hand. Karand says, Keith, did you happen to see a mouse come through here? He has something of mine. And Keith says, no. Karand says, I'll find you, Platt.
Now, just real quick, this is the very first reference to any of the names of any of the Altaian mice. Platt, that name, goes all the way back to Beast King Golion. The two adult mice from Beast King Golion were called Platt, and I don't know the pronunciation, I think it's Chuchule. That name is also used in Voltron Legendary Defender, at least in the Season 1 character litho. But to date, that name has not been mentioned in dialogue. But this is the first reference to Platt. And Platt is the really big one.
Yeah, we don't actually see the mice in this episode, though, right?
Right, right.
Right.
But Platt is the largest of the four mice.
Okay. So Karand continues down the corridor. Suddenly, Keith jumps up and follows Karand into the corridor. And Keith says, wait, Karand. Keith says, do you think the Galra ever went to Earth? Is that possible? I mean, they would have taken it over, right? And then Karand stops and turns to Keith, and they're standing right outside a door. And Karand says, oh, I think you'd know if the Galra were there. And then Keith says, the Blue Lion was there. Did a Galra pilot the Blue Lion too? And then the door opens, and Lance is on the other side. And Keith and Karan had been outside Lance's cabin. Lance is wearing a bathrobe. He has a towel on his head as if drying his hair. And he has cream all over his face.
Just like in Some Assembly Required back in season one, where he was keeping himself looking good.
And as they mentioned at WonderCon, you know, somebody had asked about Lance's skincare plan.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that the white cream in this episode might have been the food goo that had turned bad or sour. And it went from green to white.
Anyway.
So anyway, Lance says, "Hey, why are you asking about my lion? How many lions do you need?" Keith says, "What? No, I was just..." Lance says, "Don't what? No, I was just me." Lance presses his index finger into Keith's chest. He says, "You've had your eye on the blue lion from day one." And Lance crosses his arms. And Keith says, "Well, yeah, it's the first one we found." Lance flaps his fingers as if trying to shut Keith up. Ba-ba-ba-ba. And Lance says, "The blue lion's with me, and we're very happy together. Very happy."
Sounds almost like he thinks someone's trying to break up his relationship with the lion, you know, like a girlfriend or something. It's funny.
Right. So Lance backs up into his cabin and the door closes.
So what's interesting about this exchange is that, you know, obviously we know something's going on with Keith. You know, we see him looking at this, at the knife with the purple glyph. And of course, purple is the color we've seen associated with the Galra. He's asking Karan about the Galra. There's something clearly on his mind. And of course, we've all probably watched the end of the season and have more of an understanding than we would have the first time through this episode. But the fact that Keith is almost speechless when Lance accuses him of, you know, trying to take Blue Lion. For Keith, who's normally, you know, he normally has an answer for everything and doesn't put up with stuff from anybody, for him to be sort of off his game there verbally, you know, there's something big on his mind.
Yeah, and the thing about it is they've been building up to this, okay? And there's more of this buildup about this him and his knife and asking about the Galra, and we haven't even gotten to the Blade of Marmora yet.
Right. Spoilers.
Well, I'm just saying,
right,
we know how it goes, but all this buildup and stuff really makes the Blade of Marmora episode even more effective, I think.
Sure, totally agree.
You know, because we were along for this ride that Keith has been going through, and he hasn't been telling anybody about it.
Right.
All right. Then Pidge, over the intercom, says, "Guys, check this out." So the door to Lance's quarters open again, and Lance, Keith, and Karan stand listening. And then they cut to the Green Lion's hangar, and the lion sits inactive, but to its right is an alcove with computer equipment. The paladins and Karan are gathered around Pidge, and Lance is now in his normal outfit. So you hear electronic beeping and close-up of a spore hovering above some piece of lab equipment. And Hunk says, oh, I've seen this experiment. So there's a shot of everyone gathered around Pidge's lab equipment, Pidge standing at and operating a futuristic laptop computer. And Hunk says, "But, question, why do we need to get electricity from a potato?" Of course, as everybody's done the potato experiment with the positive and negative leads into it, right?
Right. And of course, it's funny that he's mentioning a potato when he compared that that control pedestal outside the castle to a curly fry. So there's some serious spudding going on here.
And then Pidge says, "What? No. I was able to crack the spores code."
Spores code.
And she chuckles.
Yeah, and this reminds me of the male Pidge from Voltron Force with the gristle defense system of the Castle of Lions. So you got to love the puns.
Yeah, she chuckled to herself about that one.
Mm-hmm.
So we see a close-up of Pidge's computer screen. There seems to be lots of symbols moving across the screen. She says, "I ran the bioluminescent pattern through a variety of code-breaking sequences, including this homemade virtual Turing machine." So we see a reverse shot of Pidge looking at the screen. Shiro, Karan, and Hunk are behind her looking at the screen. Keith is behind them. He's got his arms folded again. And then leaning back against a piece of equipment and sulking or in thought. I guess you could say he was.
Yeah. Still. Keith's got a lot on his mind.
Yeah. So Pidge says, "Of course, I had to make a few tweaks to the original design." Lance leans over from behind Hunk's right shoulder, and she says, "Because obviously there have been several advancements since he designed it." Now, what is she talking about?
She's talking about the Turing machine, which is a real thing. Look it up, everybody. Developed by Alan Turing.
Right.
And Alan Turing is a legendary computer scientist. In addition to the Turing machine bearing his name, there's also the Turing test, which is sort of a metric that people have thought might be an effective way to determine whether or not we ever develop a true artificial intelligence that can truly mimic a human being. So Alan Turing is a real computer scientist. Look him up. I think you'll be fascinated by what you read.
I did look him up.
Oh, you did? All right.
Yes. So a Turing machine is a hypothetical machine thought of by mathematician Alan Turing in 1936-37.
Mm-hmm.
It can simulate any computer algorithm, no matter how complicated, by manipulating symbols on a strip of tape according to a table of rules. And it serves as an idealized model for mathematical calculations.
There you go.
How about that? I looked it up.
You did look it up. Yes, you did. There is a movie based on Alan Turing's life. It's called The Imitation Game. It's an excellent film. I do recommend you check it out. And Turing is played by Benedict Cumberbatch. It's a movie from 2014. It's a really good movie. And Turing's life was remarkable in many ways. Unfortunately, he really wasn't appreciated for his contributions to society at large until after his very unfortunate and tragic death. And I don't mean to be a downer on this, but Alan Turing is an amazing, amazing person. And I do recommend that you, at a minimum, check out The Imitation Game. He helped to develop the Enigma machine to crack Nazi codes during World War II. So a brilliant man. He's an amazing guy.
And these are those little extra tidbits you won't get anywhere else on any other review of Greening the Cube.
Yes, and all because I am a colossal dork. So there you go.
So I'll bet you nobody else on any of their reviews of Greening the Cube even talked about this.
That's right. You know, but just be glad we didn't read the entire Wikipedia page.
Okay. So Pitch says, although you have to admit, Turing was a shining light in the world of science in an age when far too many were still... And then Keith, losing his patience, says, Pidge! And Pidge yelps. And Keith says, what does it say? So Keith's arms are still crossed.
Yeah, he's good at that.
Yeah. Pidge says, oh, yeah. Under attack. Galra. Help. And then there are coordinates. So Shiro says, it's a distress signal. Good work, Pidge.
Now, one thing I love about this is, you know, as we'll see as we get further into the episode, a code like this could only have been broken by someone, you know, truly capable of thinking outside the box and just brilliant. And that is Pidge. And, you know, as we see later in this episode, the Okari need someone like Pidge to help them in their current plight. So this distress message, as bizarre and alien and strange as it is, was perfectly suited for someone like Pidge, which is someone that they absolutely needed.
Maybe they were looking for one of the Voltron paladins to find them.
Maybe.
Maybe that's why they sent the distress signal in those spores.
Maybe.
Okay. Well, Shiro says to Karan, get those coordinates into the castle ship's navigation system. So we cut to space. There's the Castle of Line flying past the camera and toward a planet, and it's Alcarion. And then Karan says on the voiceover, the signal came from Alcarion, home to the Okari, a proud class of engineers. And it dissolves to a panning shot of an advanced city. They are builders of vast cities that could change shape at the whim of their creators. And then the camera pulls back to reveal the bridge of the Castle of Lions. The shot of the city has been a projection on the wall display at the front of the room. And Allura and Karan are at their usual stations looking at the image. The paladins are standing between Allura and Karan, and they're also looking at the image. Allura says, they had a seemingly magical ability to manipulate solid metal. Okay, she also says, with just a wave of their hands, they could build a computer inside a block of steel.
That is pretty amazing.
Yeah. So amazing that Pidge is smiling through all of this. And then you see Pidge, whoa. And then Karan says, an Okari once gave me this. And he turns his back to everyone and pulls out a black cube with a glowing band around its equator. Karan opens his hand, and the cube hovers about 5 inches above his open hand. And Lance says, what is it? Karan says, hello, it's a floating cube.
You know, this is funny on for many reasons. And one of them is that, you know, Karan is the first person to fill people's heads with all sorts of crazy alien words and techno babble and all this wonderful stuff. And here he says, it's a floating cube.
Yeah. And as he's saying this to Lance, he crosses his arms because he's very amused at himself. And the cube remains in its spot. And he continues to laugh and says, oh, this guy. And watch. And then he looks at the cube and he says, my name is Karan and I'm a gorgeous man. And then you hear beeping. And then from the cube says, my name is Karan and I'm a gorgeous man, echoing it back to him.
So it's basically a floating cube-shaped parrot.
Yeah. So Pidge's eyes are all aglow as they had been when she first saw Beezer and taking flight. She's darting all around. She can't contain herself. Keith, with his arms still crossed, says, why would a society full of literal tech wizards use spores to send a distress signal? So it's actually a valid question, right?
Sure it is.
But it never gets answered because Pidge says, who cares? When do we get to see that city?
Yeah. And I have to say that there is logic here, as we just discussed just a bit ago. But one of the things I like about this show is that there's a lot of stuff where, you know, like the mermaids, right? You know, that we saw earlier in the season. And you might ask yourself, well, why, you know, how did they get underwater? If they had all that technology, why did they completely abandon it? How can they all, assuming it's been abandoned for many years, how would any of them still have the smarts to reactivate it? And blah, 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 blah. And I love that they can just, you know, just in the dialogue say, who cares? It's mermaids. They're fun. And here, who cares? When do we get to see the city? I mean, it's nice that I do think there's definite logic to these stories, obviously, but it's sort of like Mystery Science Theater 3000 when the show starts. They say, you know, if you wonder how he eats and breathes or other science facts, repeat to yourself, it's just a show. I should really just relax. It's really that way here. And that makes the show a lot more fun, I think.
And don't forget, the show is made for kids of all ages.
That's true.
So sometimes you just need to cater to the kids of the younger ages.
Yep, that's true.
Okay, so Allura says, actually, Pidge, the distress signal isn't coming from the city. It's coming from the forest. So the wall display changes from a shot of the city to a shot of the forest. And then Pidge gasps, and then her facial expression switches from delight to disappointment. Oh... So we dissolve to the exterior view of Alcarion. The lions are flying in from off-screen and approach to the planet. Pidge looks out Green Lion's left display screen at a city as they fly by. And she says, why doesn't anyone ever send a distress signal from a cool place? And then you see an overhead shot of the lions over a forest. And Pidge says, I hate the outdoors. Nothing but sunburn and poison oak. When we cut to the inside of Red Lion's cockpit, Keith is smiling.
How often do you see Keith smile?
Not very often.
Yeah, so this is really something, especially with everything that's on his mind.
But it doesn't last very long.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, I like it out here. It's quiet. And then all of a sudden, he notices a volley of arrows being shot up at the lions. And he gasps. And then there's a five-way split screen as an arrow impacts each lion. Green is hit on the underside of its head. Black is hit in the waist. Yellow is hit on the bottom of the neck. Blue is hit on one of the speeder hatch doors. And then red is hit at the bottom of the neck. A blue-tended radiating light effect emanates from each arrow.
Man, who took notes on all that stuff anyway? That's really detailed.
I think it might have been you.
Yes, it was this time. Anyway.
Okay. So there's a five-way split screen of the paladins. And Hunk says, what was that? And Keith says, are we being attacked? Shiro says, I don't know, but something's dragging my lion down to the surface. So the lion's eyes are fading from yellow to blue, and the lions begin to descend into the trees. Now, what do you think that eye color changing means?
Well, the energy effect that we see from those arrows is blue in color. So there's that link. I mean, clearly whatever the arrow is doing, it's doing something to the lions. But of course, throughout this series, blue is a color that's associated, that really light, almost cyan color is associated with quintessence, the pure form of quintessence. So maybe that's involved here too.
Right. Okay. So Lance says, yeah, something's pulling blue down too. So the lions reach a clearing. A half dozen mech suits are standing at the clearing facing the lions. 40 or so people are standing among them. Some of the people have glowing two-handed devices and others have spears. All these implements are pointed up at the lions. The lions land in front of the people and the mech suits and their eyes return to yellow. The next scene is from Hunk's cockpit with a side image of Lance on Hunk's video screen.
Mm-hmm.
Hunk says, are those wooden mech suits? And then Lance says, are you kidding me? We got taken down by a bunch of tree people?
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, you know, the Ewoks were actually pretty good at taking down space people, weren't they?
The stormtroopers, right.
Yes. And then Doctor Who had the Cyber King in one of the more recent episodes, made entirely out of wood, this enormous wood robotic thing. So, you know, don't discount the robots made out of wood.
Right. The next image we see is looking up at Black Lion. And Shiro, over his speaker, says, we come in peace. And then a hooded being, presumably an Alkari, steps forward and removes her hood. It's Reiner, although we don't know that yet. Reiner says, could it be Voltron? A small hatch opens on top of Green Lion's head. Pidge emerges, holding a spore inside a small containment unit. And Pidge says, we found your distress signal.
Now, before we continue, I must point out, as a certifiable dork, that we've seen three different ways to get into the lions. We've got the mouth. You could climb in through the mouth, as we saw in The Rise of Voltron. Obviously, the speeders can get them in and out through those hatches on their bellies, the chests of the lion. And we've seen that in Some Assembly Required. I think that was the first time we saw that. And then, of course, the little hatch in the top of the head. We saw Pidge drop into the lion cockpit back in the first episode of this second season. But here we are seeing, you know, we're actually seeing the hatch from the outside. So if you're keeping score, there are at least three ways to get into a lion.
Okay. Pidge said, we found your distress signal. And then Reiner says, praise Lubos. And she's smiling. The other Alkari close their eyes and hold their hands up as if thanking a deity, and they all chime in, Lubos! We dissolve to a shot of Alkari and paladins walking up an incline, stopping at a lookout point. Reiner says, when the Galra attacked, only a few of us escaped the cities. We were forced to flee into the forest. Shiro says, how long have you lived like this? Reiner says, many decaphibes. Of course, we know that's the equivalent to decades, right?
Or something thereabout, yeah. You know, a lot of fans have debated how long these different time units are, and we'll learn more about decaphibes and how they equate to some of the other forthcoming time units in later episodes of this season. But clearly it's meant to be a really long time, and decades sounds as reasonable as anything.
Right. So we now see that the Alkari and the paladins are seeing an advanced city has been built into and interconnecting the trees. The buildings glow green. So Reiner says, but as you can see, our people are resilient. We never stopped evolving. So Reiner says, instead, we adapted our skills to the environment. Pidge, who's still smiling, is completely mesmerized by what she's seeing. We dissolve to the ground level. We see a green glowing lamp at the top of a tower of tree growth. Pidge runs toward it. The paladins follow walking. And can I just say here, I love the music in this episode.
Oh, yes.
It's so much different than the other episodes. It has a feeling of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of get that sense when I'm listening to the music.
Yes. Kudos to the soundtrack of this in every episode. But yes, definitely there's a different feel here.
All right. So an Alkari stands beneath the tower. It seems to sculpt an insect out of wood by gliding its fingers over the wood. The torso of the insect glows green, and the insect flies away. Pidge says, Karan was right, Reiner. You really are the most incredible engineers in the universe. To be able to switch from working with precision machinery to a bunch of sticks. And then Reiner says, nature's designs are superior to any that we could devise. And Pitch says, "No offense, but I'll take my computer over a tree any day." And Shiro says, "You two can talk science later. Let's assemble Voltron and get rid of these Galra invaders." Reiner says, "It's not that simple, I'm afraid. The Galra have our leader, Lubos." And then all the old Kari say solemnly, "Lubos." So Reiner says, "If you attack, who knows what they'll do to him?" And then Shiro says, "Then we'll just have to rescue him." So we cut to a tall tower in a city at sunrise. The camera tracks down to reveal a pile of enormous black rectilinear shapes that resemble giant three-dimensional Tetris objects.
Yeah, and just to clarify, when we say rectilinear, we're talking about rectangular and linear, not what the first two syllables might also sound like.
So the shapes have glowing purple, horizontally and vertically oriented veins. So the platforms jut out from the faces on the shapes, and on each platform, there's like three or four Okari. So Galra, they just say Galra in this. There's
a character, a single Galra in this episode.
A commander.
And he's called, the only time he's ever referenced by any name or title, he's just called Commander. So this Galra is actually never named in the episode.
That is just completely strange to me.
It is.
I mean, so you would think they would give him a name.
Yeah, and I'm sure that behind the scenes he probably has one. You know, that season one character Litho had names of, you know, for example, the Robeast that fought Voltron on the Balmera, and the mice were identified by name in that poster or that lithograph, which you can see on Voltron.com, by the way. We don't have a similar illustration for season two. So if this Galra has a name, we don't yet know. So if anyone working on the show would like to clue us in, we would greatly appreciate it.
Well, this is one of those things that Benjamin told us about, you know, the fact that he likes to know these behind the scenes types of things where nobody really knows what the names were, but somebody did name them after all.
Yeah. So in the meantime, yeah. I guess we could call him Fred, but that doesn't sound right.
Okay. So the Galra commander says through a speaker, "Work faster, faster." And the Okari are grunting. The Okari are seen to be standing side by side on their platforms. Their hands are pressed against the rectilinear shapes, and they appear to be concentrating and exerting mental energies. Purple-colored arcs of light and what resembles alien computer code seem to radiate from their hands across the surfaces of the shapes. We see an observation and control room overlooking the rectilinear shapes and Okari laborers. A muscular Galra, the one we heard over the speaker, oversees the situation. Four sentries stand with him. Let me just first say about this guy, his right ear, his right eye, and other parts of the right side of his face and head are metal and cybernetic. Why don't we just call him Cyborg?
Okay. Cyborg Galra. No.
So the Galra commander says, "For a bunch of slaves with magical metal working powers, they're taking an awfully long time to build my super weapon." And he says, "Perhaps they need a little bit of motivation. Show them their king." So outside in the sky, we see a hovering Galra drone. It looks like Rover and the bomb drone from the previous episodes. The drone fires a purple laser from its eye. In a wide shot, we see that there are two arrangements of shapes with Okari working on them, high above a courtyard between the two stacks. We see there are four drones. Each is firing a laser at its neighbor. The drones and lasers form the corners and edges, respectively, of a rectangular holographic display. The display shows footage of Lubos, his hands and head secured in a pillory. That's the stocks that hold your head and arms.
Yeah, so if you go to Renaissance festivals or anything like that, you know, for a photo op, you stick your head and your hands through those holes. That's what it is. I Googled it because I had no idea that thing was called.
Yep. So Lubos says, no more. Please don't hurt me. The Okari laborers gasp and sob. The Okari double their efforts. More veins glow on the rectilinear shapes. So I like how you said double their efforts.
Yes, that was a Return of the Jedi reference, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes,
we shall
it
double
was.
Our efforts. I hope so, Commander, for your sake. So anyway, sorry.
Yes. And the Galra commander says, that's more like it. The paladins and Okari stand on a hill with large red flowers, and Keith says, Reiner, where are we? And Reiner says, this is the armory. And Alkari holds out his or her right hand toward a flower. A device on the right forearm glows, and flower petals extend and engulf the Alkari's right forearm. Green-colored circuitry glows on the forearm enclosure. It's a weapon. The Alkari test fires it, and a green energy beam fires from the barrel of the weapon. You said one of the paladins can't tell which. They all say, whoa?
Yeah.
I think they all said it.
Okay.
Even though it doesn't say who said it, I think they're all saying, whoa.
They probably are. And Pidge has that look on her face again like, whoa, it's technology. Yeah. It's so cool.
Yeah, the glowing eyes and everything. Mm-hmm. So Reiner touches a tall tree. Her forearm device glows and green glowing circuitry flows up the tree trunk.
Mm-hmm.
To a limb and into a large sphere-shaped organic pod that almost resembles a giant coconut. The pod falls to the ground and unfolds into a long-armed biped. It's a mech. A cockpit hatch opens to reveal a pilot compartment. And they all scream and gasp, and Hunk goes, huh? And Lance goes, cool. Keith says, can I get one of those?
Wow, I want one too.
This is like Willy Wonka, right? Yes, you can all have one.
That's right.
So Reiner places her hand over a flower. Its petals open, revealing five glowing organic crowns. Reiner hands one to each paladin. And then Reiner says, now, the key to operating it is understanding that the nanocellulose responds to electrical impulses from the neural pathways connected through this. And what she means by this is the crown.
Mm-hmm.
So Lance says, do what now? Hunk touches his crown with his tongue. He's trying to eat it. He goes, makes my tongue itchy.
I keep thinking, and you know, this is just, I keep thinking about past Voltron shows too. And, you know, him tasting it reminds me a little bit of back in Voltron Force where they first encounter that spider roe beast. And Hunk, it gets in, it encases itself in a web or a cocoon. And Hunk says, should we poke it? So this is one of those Hunk moments.
Yeah, so Pidge says, that's your interface? And Reiner says, of course, all commands need to come as binary coded messages. So Pidge walks over to a tree. And she goes, so, like this? She places her hand on the tree trunk and closes her eyes, concentrating. The jewel on the front of her crown glows. From Pidge's hand, circuitry flows up the tree to another pod. The pod falls to the ground and opens, as Reiner's had done. Reiner is now seated in her mech, and Reiner says, yes, excellent. Lance says, I think mine is just a tree. Reiner says, you must have a deep connection with nature. So Pidge is now seated in her mech. Pidge says, not really. My allergies and pale skin don't mix with outdoor living.
Nice.
And Shiro says, Pidge is our resident tech expert. Reiner says, well, that explains it. Like the Alkari, you understand that at the deepest level, trees, metal, you, me, we're all made of the same cosmic dust, all arranged by the laws of mathematics. Pidge says, does this mean I should start gardening?
Ha ha.
So Reiner says, it means you're going to need to give your friends a ride.
Isn't that neat that she is so, even though she doesn't, you know, she's not really in tune with nature yet, it's cool that this is something Pidge can do that no one else on the team can. Pretty cool.
All right, so the mechs are hovering on all fours through the forest. Reiner says, this way, to the edge of the forest to save our king. In a two-way split screen, we see Pidge, Lance, and Hunk in Pidge's mech, and then Reiner, Shiro, and Keith in Reiner's mech. We cut to the rectilinear shapes assembling into an enormous, seamless obsidian cube. Veins of purple circuitry decorate portions of the surface. So these things all came together sort of like you said before, like Tetris.
Right.
Forming a perfect cube. And then the Galwar commander says, finally, the cube is ready for launch. Load the top Alkari engineers onto our ships and prepare for departure. After the cube destroys Alkarian, hopefully Zarkon will welcome us back to the main fleet.
This guy is bad to the bone, isn't he?
Yeah, he's ready to destroy this whole planet.
Yeah, and to think he's that nasty and Zarkon still had him kicked out.
Yeah.
I mean, geez, it makes you wonder who the A-listers are in the Galwar Empire, doesn't it?
Yes. So we see a shot of the city. The camera scans the city. Picture-in-picture images show sentries at various locations. Reiner says, "Their headquarters are impenetrable from the ground." The camera pulls back. We've been looking at a display screen inside Reiner's mech. So Keith and Shiro are also looking at it. But there is one way in, a small opening in the roof. It goes all the way down to an open courtyard. Keith says, "That's quite a drop." Reiner says, "But there you will have total access to the building. The hard part will be getting onto the roof undetected." Shiro says, "That won't be a problem."
And one thing that's fun here is that, you know, the Okari really have it going on as far as technology is concerned, but it's neat that the Paladins still have their own ace in the hole, which is, of course, Green Lion.
Yes. All right, so Hunk sees the cube at the installation, and he says, hey, what's that? Is that part of the building? Reiner says, "My Lubos, it can't be." From Reiner's point of view at her display screen, a picture-in-picture shot of Pidge's mech cockpit appears. Pidge is holding up Karan's cube. Pidge says, "Hey, that looks like the cube Karan gave me." Reiner says, "I haven't seen one of those in many Decaphebes." Reiner says, "We used to play with them as children." Reiner's point of view moves back to the large cube outside. "But this, only King Lubos could have designed one that size." And then Keith says, "Why would he do that?" Reiner says, "They must have forced him to reveal his designs and reconstruct it as a weapon. From the looks of it, I'd say it's almost finished." Shiro says, "Okay, we need to act fast. Everyone, back to base. I have a plan." So we dissolve to Green Lion launching from the ground and into the sky. So Shiro, on the voiceover, says, "First we'll need to get to the top of that tower." Green Lion flies toward the city and cloaks. Since the Green Lion has stealth capabilities, Pidge, you're the dropship. You'll take Keith, Hunk, Lance, and me to the roof, then drop back to a safe position.
And once again, I love on this show that they actually have plans, and they're detailed. They sound like they really know what they're doing, you know? Shiro really is great at forming strategies and then explaining to his team and, of course, the viewing audience exactly what's going on. You know, this isn't a typical cartoon where the good guys just run into battle and go, you know, "Yo, Joe," or, you know, "Autobots, roll for it," or whatever. You know, it's... These guys have got a strategy and a plan, and they're following it. And I love that. It just makes them really seem like they've got their stuff together.
And we didn't have to see it all in, like, a miniature form first.
Yes. You know? Yeah.
We actually saw it in the way that they did it on the A-Team movie. Did you see the A-Team movie?
Oh, my gosh. I actually love that movie. It is so stupid. It loops right around and becomes fun.
Right. When they show them actually describing what the plan is and everything, it's really cool how they enact it out and everything.
Yeah, and of course, we've already seen the Paladins doing that back in the Deaths, where they were working with the Rebels, right? So the
right,
Rebels are
right.
With the Mermaids, you know, and of course, they've got all the Turtle and all the rest of that cool stuff. So, but yeah, back to that A-Team movie, loved it. Oh, anyway, it's so dumb, love it.
Okay, so looking down through a hatch in Green Lion's underbelly, we see Shiro, Keith, Hunk, and Lance drop through the hatch and into a large hollow in the top of a tower. The Paladins use their jetpacks to slow their descent. They land in a courtyard, and at the center of which is a tree. So in this scene, I just want to say the detail, the shading, the lighting are very intricate in this scene.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
So a BlipTech sensor deploys and begins to scan the interior of the tower. So Shiro says, after the drop, we'll use a sensor to scan the building for any Alkari biorhythms. So Pidge is in Green Lion's cockpit, sees an indication of a single Alkari biorhythm in the building. Then you hear rapid beeping. The location appears in a heads-up display on Shiro's visor. The Paladins enter the building and run to a hatch at the end of a corridor. Now there's moaning and sobbing inside. The Paladins enter, discovering Lubos sitting, eating, and watching an alien daytime drama TV program. It looks like a soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
On an enormous TV screen. He's crying at the show. Another Okari stands at Lubos's side, skinny, wearing rags, and bound at the wrists. The sobbing continues. Lubos says, "Betrayal." More sobbing. "She loves you." And then Shiro says, King Lubos? And Lubos looks back and says, yes, who are you? The jesters I requested?
So, you know, is it not the case that Lubos is just a grade A schmuck?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Yeah, yeah. So Lance says, we're here to, like, rescue you. So Lubos says, And then he presses a control on the armrest of his chair. And then an alarm blares. The side wall opens, revealing 10 armed sentries plus the Galra commander we saw earlier. Hunk says, you could have just said no thanks. That would have made it all easier for them, obviously.
Yeah.
But the Galra commander says, looks like someone came to rescue you, Lubos. Shiro says, you turned your back on your people to save your own skin? And Lubos says, I'm doing this for my people. And Lubos says, they wanted to fight the Galra, but they are too powerful. The Galra could destroy us. And Lance says, so you helped enslave your people to build some super weapon? Lubos says, don't make me the bad guy. He forced me to do it. And Lance says, did he force feed you too?
Yeah, we should point out that Lubos is considerably larger than the other Okari in the room. So we pointed out in the description of the scene that the one who's bound at the wrists and wearing rags is extremely lean, as are all of the Okari that we've seen, except for Lubos.
Yeah, Lubos is the biggest Okari we've seen by far.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's because he's overindulged.
Yeah, he's kind of like Boss Nass in Star Wars Episode 1 among the Gungans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
Yeah, I just invoked Star Wars Episode 1. I apologize.
Yeah. All right, so Lubos says, and then Keith says, you're no king. And then he runs towards Lubos. Lubos's servant named Lasai.
Mm-hmm.
Punches Lubos, who falls into Keith's grasp. Keith stands behind Lubos, has his Bayard near Lubos's chest. Keith says, okay, we're walking out of here. Anyone tries to stop us, and Lubos gets it.
Now, one thing I didn't get is in the establishing shot that showed Lubos watching the soap opera and having Lasai stand at his side. Lasai's wrists look to be bound, but I'm not sure how Lasai, you know, is able to punch Lubos.
Well, it didn't seem more like a punch, more like a push.
Okay.
With both hands at the same time. So I think Lasai is still bound, but just pushed with the weight that Lasai had towards Lubos.
Okay. Point taken.
Just to make sure that Lubos got caught by Keith.
Right, right.
So the other paladins are shocked by Keith's maneuver, by the way.
Oh, yeah, with good reason.
Yeah, Shiro says, whoa, Keith. And then Lance says, that came out of nowhere. So Lubos says, Lasai, what are you doing? Lasai says, you betrayed our people. I can't live this lie anymore. And Keith says, you don't want me to hurt your genius engineer, right? And then the Galra commander says, oh, be my guest. His work is done. The cube is complete. Lubos says, what? But I thought we had a deal.
This actually reminds me a little bit, and I'm going to invoke a different Star Wars movie, The Empire Strikes Back, where, you know, Lando agrees to let the Empire arrive at Cloud City on Bespin and do their nefarious stuff. And Vader changes the deal. And, you know, Lando says, you know, but we had a deal, you know. I'm altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it further.
This deal is getting worse all the time.
Yeah, yeah. This scene reminds me just a bit of the exchange between Lando Calrissian and Darth Vader. In a good way.
Yeah. The Galra commander says, guards, put them all out of their misery. So a beam from off screen blows a hole in the wall beside the Galra and the sentries. It's Green Lion. So they all scream. There's grunting and coughing. Pidge on the voiceover over the speaker says, your ride is here. The Galra stands, the sentries fire at Green Lion and the paladins, and the Galra commander says, engage the cube, take down the lion.
Yes, because we all know that 10 sentries can take down a lion.
So the paladins and Lubos jetpack through the hole in the building and land on top of the shield on Green Lion's back. Then the cube can be seen to start lifting from the ground, and Shiro over voiceover says, the cube is operational. We've got to get back to the other lions and form Voltron. So Pitch says, on it. And then Green Lion flies away. It appears the paladins have entered Green Lion as they can no longer be seen on the lion's back.
Mm-hmm. I just thought I'd fill in that minor detail.
For those of you wondering if they had gotten inside the lion.
They did.
Before the lion pulled away.
Yes.
Sort of like the way Luke did in the Millennium Falcon at Cloud City.
Yes. Hey, that sounds like a parallel. So, yeah, they didn't just all roll off the shield and fall to their deaths below. They actually got into the lion. Isn't that nice?
Yes. So there's a shot of the ground as Lubos falls to it on his hands and knees, and the Alkari watch the scene from various locations. The Alkari are murmuring, "Lubos." And then Reiner says, "What's going on?" And Shiro says, "While your countrymen starved, King Lubos was well taken care of by the Galra. He willingly helped them build that cube, willingly helped to enslave his own people." And they all gasp, and you hear one of them say, "Lubos." And then Shiro says, "I know you're devastated, but it's time to be strong and use your Alkari spirit to fight alongside Voltron and take back your planet." Reiner says, "Lubos, how could you?" Lubos says, I was only trying to." And she says, "Enough! We must free our people." The Alkari are cheering. The lions form Voltron in the normal sequence that you know.
Yes, we know and love.
Yes.
Hang on a sec. Dun, 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 dun. Okay, enough of that. They form Voltron. Isn't it cool?
Yeah. So they form Voltron. There's roars and everything. Okay. There's a shot of the planet's surface. The cube is hovering and moving slowly across a large body of water. Voltron descends from above. Shiro says, "All right, team, let's take that thing down." The cube fires an energy beam at Voltron. Voltron dodges several blasts. Shiro says, "Form shield." Voltron's shield blocks several shots from the cube. Keith says, "Let's see how tough this magic cube is." Red Lion's mouth laser fires and hits the cube, which seems to absorb the beam. The cube then fires back. Voltron blocks the beam with its shield. Pidge said, "Did it just absorb our lasers?" Shiro immediately says, "We need to increase firepower. Hunk, use your blaster." Pidge says, "I'm not sure this is a good idea," but Hunk says, "Got it." Voltron forms the shoulder cannon and fires a sustained beam at the cube.
Is it just me, or is that shoulder cannon all kinds of awesome?
It is.
I mean, the sword is cool. The Voltron's got all sorts of great weapons, but that shoulder cannon is really, really slick. That's all.
Yep. So Hunk says, "Yeah, I think it's working." But the cube fires back a sustained beam like that from Voltron's shoulder cannon. Voltron blocks the beam with a shield, but the robot is pushed back by the force of the beam. Shiro says, "It's giving back whatever we fire into it, like Karan's Echo Cube." Pidge said, "That's what I was trying to tell you guys. It's learning, making its own versions of our weapons to use against us." Lance says, "We can't just sit here. We gotta move." So Voltron flies out of the path of the beam. The beam tracks Voltron and hits him in the back, and he falls face down. Voltron takes off and flies over the treetops, and the cube pursues. And Hunk says, "How do we beat it?" Lance says, "Maybe if we form our sword, we can cut through the surface, hack right into the center thinking point place." "Can't be any worse than what's happening now," says Keith. Shiro says, "Let's do it. Form sword." So Voltron forms the sword. Voltron flies at high speed toward the cube, dodging its energy blast, and then cuts the cube in half.
Bye-bye, or not.
Pidge says, "It's working." A glowing purple equatorial band appears on each half cube.
So basically what we've been seeing every time that we see this cube doing its thing is that there's this band. I mean, if you look at the Death Star, right? Going back to Star Wars, here we go. You know, it's got that around the equator of the Death Star, there's that band, right? You know what I'm talking about. It's like a groove that goes around the circumference. Well, here we're looking at a cube, but there's this band that goes around it about halfway up, and it glows purple. So just as the swords cut the cube in half, each half cube has the same band, which shows each of these things is going to be a menace in its own right.
Yep. So Shiro says, "It's still operational. Re-engage." Voltron bisects each half cube with one swing of the sword. So now there's four cubes.
Yeah, so I tweeted about this earlier this week. It said, how do you cut a cube in half, cut each half cube in half and wind up with four cubes. It doesn't work. But then I remembered, oh yeah, earlier in the episode, they said that the Okari could change the shapes and change their cities around with a thought. So, you know, cubes look cooler than 2x1x1 shapes. And yes, I'm a total dork for knowing the ratios, but I'm just going to chalk it up to the Okari's amazing abilities. How's that?
Okay.
Yeah.
So the quarter cubes fall toward the treetops. And Hunk says, "We did it! They're going down!" A glowing purple equatorial band appears on each minicube. The minicubes then assume positions around Voltron. And Lance says, "Uh-oh." The minicubes open fire on Voltron. Voltron blocks or dodges some, but not all. And Shiro says, "We gotta move! Move!" Voltron flies upward. The cubes pursue while continuing to fire. Voltron is hit by some of the blasts. Shiro says, "We can't fight them like this. We need to split up. Back into Lions." So cut to the Galra control room, and the Galra and two sentries watching the midair battle, we see Voltron separate into Lions. The Galra commander says, "Excellent. Voltron doesn't stand a chance against my weapon."
Of course. Voltron can't defeat anything.
So the Galra commander says, "Soon I'll have both the cube and Voltron to present to Emperor Zarkon." So Blue Lion turns to face the mini-cubes, and Lance says, "Let's see if I can freeze these guys." Lance fires Blue Lion's ice ray at one of the mini-cubes. The mini-cube is covered with ice, but then it shatters the ice and fires its own ice ray back at Blue Lion. Blue Lion's head becomes immersed in ice. So we see a picture-in-picture shot of Lance. You can see his breath in the air. Lance says, "Oh no, so cold, so cold." So Keith in Red Lion fires his heat ray at Blue Lion's head, melting the ice. And Lance says, oh, thanks, Keith. And Keith says, "You got it."
Yeah, the funny thing here is that Keith probably enjoyed shooting at Blue Lion and Lance.
Well, Hunk says, "Shiro, what are we going to do?" Shiro says, "There doesn't seem to be any way to stop them. But we can't let this weapon get into Zarkon's hands." Green Lion flies between two mini-cubes. Both mini-cubes fire at Green Lion, hitting it. Pidge screams. Shiro says, "Pidge!" Reiner and another Okari are watching as Green Lion streaks down toward the ground. Reiner says, "The Green Lion's in trouble." Green Lion crashes. And then Hunk says over voiceover, "Pidge, are you okay?" Green Lion is tangled in vines. The lion eyes are dark, and arcs of electricity flicker across the lion's surface.
Yeah, we've seen this before, as early as the Rise of Voltron, when the lions are just laying there or kind of staggering, and they got all that crazy electrical stuff going on around them. That's a bad thing.
Yep. Cut to the Green Lion's cockpit. Pidge is recovering, and then Pidge is groaning. Reiner, over the voiceover, says, "Pidge, can you hear me?" Pidge says, "Yeah. Wait." There's a shot of Reiner, eyes closed, hand outstretched, touching something off-screen at screen right. Presumably it's Green Lion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Pitch says, "How am I hearing you?" Reiner says, "That's not important right now. We need to get your lion back up and running." So we see a wide shot of Green Lion, not moving on the ground, still tangled in vines. Several Okari are standing around the lion. Reiner says, "I think we can heal your lion's body. But you must bond with its spirit if it is to fly again." We see a shot of Pidge in the cockpit. Pidge says, "But I thought we bonded already." And Reiner says, "Your bond must be stronger." Pidge closes her eyes. Pidge says, "Come on, girl, I need you."
This is not the first time we've heard Pidge refer to Green Lion as girl, but I love that, you know, even though Pidge is all about technology and all that, Pidge has sort of anthropomorphized Green Lion and given it a gender and an identity, which is really neat. I just think that's a neat touch.
Okay. Reiner is still touching something, presumably Green Lion, right?
Mm-hmm.
The shot of one of Green Lion's feet, Okari are touching it, the vines begin to glow.
Yeah.
So Reiner says, "Remember what I said, you, the lion, the Okari, we are all made of the same essence." We see Green Lion's head on. All the vines are glowing. Tiny glowing spores seem to warm up and around the vines and the lion. In the cockpit, camera closes to Pidge, where eyes are still closed.
Basically, at this point, Pidge is concentrating on bonding with Green Lion. And Pidge is sort of having these visions, almost like Pidge can sense the battle. And so Pidge is actually hearing Shiro reaching out to Pidge. So Pidge is actually hearing Shiro say, "Where are you, Pidge? We need you."
Now the shot is of Lyons being hit, cuts back to Pidge, suggesting that Pidge is sensing all of this somehow. And then Keith says, "Pidge!" And then the groaning continues, "Pidge!" We see an effect that suggests that Pidge has formed a deeper spiritual connection with Green Lion. We see Green Lion stand up, eyes glowing, radiating green-colored rays of light. Green Lion roars. We see red, blue, and yellow lions all grounded with flickering energy as if the lions are stunned. Black Lion crashes to the ground, joining them. The four mini-cubes slowly approach the grounded lions. In a four-way split screen, we see the paladins preparing mentally for the worst.
Yeah, they know that their time is up, or they think their time is up.
And then Pidge says, "Guys, hang on!" And they all say, "Pidge!" And then Green Lion races into view, flying around the mini-cubes in a crazy flight pattern, attempting to get their attention. And Hunk says, "Whoa, Pidge! What's going on? You're booking!" Pidge says, "I'm not sure, but I feel more connected with my lion than ever." And Pidge says, "I know what I have to do." Pidge flies Green Lion upward, then Green Lion turns to face the mini-cubes. As it spins, its shield disappears, replaced by a large weapon. The weapon fires an enormous green energy beam that impacts one of the mini-cubes. After a beat, a growth of vines bursts from the center of the mini-cube's front face. The tendril-like vines reach back and envelop the mini-cube. The mini-cube begins to descend.
Yeah, so another thing I neglected to point out in the notes is that it's kind of a subtle thing that's easy to miss. So the vines sort of, you know, burst out and wrap around the cube. If you look closely, you'll see that there's a secondary vine that comes out of the side of the cube. And I think that this is a subtle way to suggest that the cube is trying to fire back, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, so it's been hit by this vine ray. And the vine ray is having its effect on the cube. And then the cube, it's almost like it's trying to mimic that vine, but to no avail. That secondary vine also wraps around the cube. So it's actually a really neat, subtle thing.
Okay. And then Lance says, "Whoa, how'd you do that?" And then another mini cube fires a Green Lion. Pitch says, "That's right. Circle up, everybody. Get some of this." And then Green Lion fires at another mini cube, which also becomes enveloped in vines. Green Lion fires at the last two mini-cubes, and they become enveloped in vines. So the last two mini-cubes slowly descend to the ground, joining the first two, which are already on the ground. So they're all not moving now. Hunk chuckles and says, "Vines." So Hunk says, "Well, that is not the way I thought a giant cube of death would go down." So there's a shot from the Galra control room from behind the display screen looking through to the display at the Galra. The display shows that all four mini-cubes are not moving. The Galra slams his fist on the control panel. And the Galra commander says, "No!" So a Galra subordinate says, "Commander, we have to evacuate." And the Galra subordinate says, "The cube is down and the Olkari have taken back the city." So we see shots of Olkari rebels and Olkari mechs attacking the Galra sentries in the city.
So this is the confirmation that, yes, they listened to Shiro. They're acting. They're helping Voltron free the Olkari.
Right. So the commander growls, and the Galra returns as if to exit the control room. We see triumphant Olkari standing in the city among wrecked Galra sentries. In the background, a Galra battleship is slowly lifting off and into the sky. And they're all cheering. All the Olkari are cheering. So we dissolve to Reiner facing the paladins as the Olkari continue to celebrate, and Reiner says, "I want to thank you all. You helped us get our home back." Reiner says, "And for that, we will never be able to repay you." Shiro says, "Just promise me that when it's time to take the fight to Zarkon, we can count on the Olkari for help." And Reiner and Shiro shake hands. Reiner says, "Now and forever." So Reiner turns to Pidge. "And you, the spirit of the Olkari resides in you." Reiner puts her hand on Pidge's shoulder. "The bond between you and your lion has grown stronger than ever." And Pidge says, "Without you, I would never have been able to unlock my lion's hidden power." So we dissolve to the bridge of the Castle of Lions. Pidge sits on the raised platform at the center of the room. Alora, Karan, and the paladin stand around her. And Shiro says, "Nice job, Pidge." Pidge says, "You know, it's weird. I've always been a tech junkie. That's how I connected with the world." but for the first time, I feel connected to everything. I guess it's like Reiner said, we're all made up of the same cosmic dust. So we cut to Keith, and now Keith says, so that means we're all related. This ship, those stars, the Olkari. And then Keith looks down at his right hand, which is closed, as if it's holding something.
So here's the thing. Keith is thinking, he's like, the ship, those stars, the Okari. He's looking down at his right hand, and there's nothing in his right hand.
Right.
But he has his hand closed as if he's holding on to something, as if maybe he's holding on to the blade that we saw him holding earlier in the episode. He's thinking about the blade.
And then he says, even the Galra. And then Hunk says, uh-oh, I think Keith just blew his own mind. And then they all laugh, and Hunk is amused, almost acting as if he were Keith. What? And then Karan says, well, that was a productive trip. Look at all these cubes they gave me. Karan throws his echo cube upward. In a shot looking downward at everyone, the cube splits into 8 mini cubes that slowly fly in a circle. And he says, Karan, Karan, the gorgeous man. And they all echo, Karan, Karan, the gorgeous man. Ah, sounds pretty good. And they all echo, ah, sounds pretty good. And then Hunk makes a fart noise.
With his mouth, yeah. So, how's that?
And then... So they're all laughing, gasping, and then all of a sudden an alarm blares, and Hunk goes, whoa. And then Karan says, what's that? And then you hear the echo from the minicubes. What's that? So we cut to space, we see the Castle of Lions facing the camera. Behind it, we see a rift-like effect. Zarkon's Galra command ship appears, streaks until it's right behind the castle ship and slows to a near stop. 2 squadrons of Galra battleships, 20 ships each, appear on either side of the command ship.
And yes, I counted. 20 ships each.
And Karan says, oh, no. And then the echo, oh, no. And that's the end of the episode.
What'd you think of this episode?
Well, here's the thing. I already know this, but what I love about this episode is that it leads right into the next episode. So it's almost like it's a two-parter.
Right, right, right.
But we don't leave this episode with a great feeling because, as was mentioned at the very beginning of this episode, Zarkon could show up anytime.
And guess what just happened?
Yes. So it all leads back. Remember, they set these little things ahead of what actually happens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you don't pay attention to these little things sometimes, you might not catch that.
Yeah. You can see the artistry, the creativity, and the, frankly, the engineering of the plot, of the series as a whole, of this season's arc, and just within this episode. I mean, I love that these various story points that get laid out in this episode and an earlier episode all come home to roost in different ways as the show progresses. And seeing this progression of Keith as, you know, eventually, you know, there's the great mystery is going to get dealt with, you know, directly later this season. But seeing all this stuff play out, especially after you've watched it all the way through and you go back and watch it again, it's just really neat to see how the writers laid all this out.
And I love that this was a Pidge episode.
Yes, yes, indeed. With plenty of subtle character development for Keith. I mean, I don't know about subtle, but it's secondary to the main plot, but it is very critical to the plot of the season as a whole.
Right, and constantly, every time we see Keith, folded arms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just...
I keep thinking, I'm so emo.
Yeah, I mean, all through that decontamination unit, you know, every single time they went through another step in the decontamination unit, his arms were folded.
Yeah, yeah. But it was great to see him happy, even though it was just for a brief moment, being out there, flying among the trees in the forest, to see him at peace. It makes me wonder if, you know, going back to the Rise of Voltron, he has himself kind of holed up in this cabin where he's staying to, as he tries to figure out the mystery that ultimately leads them all to discover Blue Lion. Is he there just because it happens to be close to where Blue Lion winds up being? Or is he also there because he's very isolated and can find some kind of peace that he may be finding here for those brief moments? He's clearly got a lot of inner turmoil. It seems like he does try to enjoy the rare opportunities that he has for solace and for inner peace. And it's neat to see him get some of that, even if it's just for a few seconds.
Yep. it's nice to see that. Of course, none of these characters can get a whole lot of good feelings going on for very long before something happens, because you have to have that conflict to be a great story, right?
Right, right.
So it's never going to be very happy for very long, even when they were doing the snowball fight.
Yeah, that was a fun thing, too. And of course, Keith enjoyed himself there, you know, throwing the snowball at Lance. And again, I'm sure he got a kick out of finding some motivation to blast Lance and Blue Lion in the head with the heat ray.
Right. Yeah, no problem.
I got this.
Yeah. It was great that Pidge got this new bond with Green Lion and found out this new power.
Mm-hmm.
So now, what are the other possibilities with this weapon that Green Lion has?
I guess only time will tell. But one thing that we do know is that the toy of the legendary Green Lion actually has that weapon. You can pop the shield off its back, just like the shield disappears in this show, and then that weapon appears to shoot the vine ray. But of course, instead of shooting vines, it shoots a cute little blue missile.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a great toy. Did I mention those are great toys?
Yeah. Did I hear that you also have another vintage toy with you?
Oh, yes. I wanted to mention that. So, you know, I collect Voltron stuff, old and new, and I recently purchased through eBay a vintage toy from 1986 or so, made by a company called LJN. It's called a Sword Blazer. So in addition to the various transforming toys they made back in the day, Matchbox, Panache Place, and LJN's own motorized lions, LJN also made these toys that they're basically vehicles, and you can stick them on a little launcher and press a button and the little vehicles will roll across your table or the floor or whatever. And so back in the day, LJN made a black lion, and its launcher was shaped like a blazing sword. There was a blue lion that had the same launcher. And then there were two enemy things. There was a red row beast and then Lotor's ship. That fighter that he used to fly around in that had those bat wings. And right. That's what this is. So this is Lotor's ship. It's a cutesy little kind of a chibi, super deformed kind of representation of the ship. But it's really cool. It's, to my knowledge, the only toy that was ever made of Lotor's fighter. And wow. I have it. Yeah, so I have it on the blister card. And I don't plan to open it, even though the blister card is in a rather sad shape. But what's interesting is that they've misspelled Lotor's name. It actually says Lotar, L-O-T-A-R.
Oh.
Yeah, and this particular package seems to be of European origin, or perhaps Canadian origin, because it has a French decal at the bottom, and there's a little label on the front of the card as well. So I am a huge fan of Voltron toys, as I said, old and new, and merchandise of various kinds. And I think it's kind of fun to chat here and there about merchandise from days of long ago. If you are a fellow Voltron collector, feel free to reach out to us here at the podcast at letsvoltronpodcast@gmail.com and share some of your favorite collectibles, whether they're from the Voltron Legendary Defender or any of the previous shows.
Very cool. Very cool.
This was a fun show. I did not expect to see vines. I mean, we all know from if you've watched Voltron in the past, you know that Green Lion has this connection with the forest. You see that in the main title sequence of Voltron Legendary Defender, where it launches out of the trees. In the first episode, it was in this tree growth kind of thing. You know, so there's clearly some kind of a connection with nature. But to actually have a weapon that sprouts vines out of whatever you hit with the weapon is really surprising. And when you see that vine sprout out, it really surprised me watching it. It was just kind of a unique thing. You know, usually in shows like this, you expect to see laser beams and all that other fancy stuff. And of course, being Voltron, you expect to see swords and other kinds of bladed weapons. But to have something that was based on organic technology was really kind of cool and fun.
Yeah, which is why I think in the future we're going to see other versions of this that's not just going to be vines.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see all kinds of things that could come from this.
Yeah, I'm wondering if Pidge's reference to poison oak might be foreshadowing.
I hope not.
Yeah, Pidge plugs in her the Bayard, and then all of a sudden a bunch of poison oak sprays out of Green Lion's mouth, and the Roby starts scratching itself, you know. Maybe not.
We've already seen Karan get the slipperies.
Oh, yes, that's right.
I would not want to see Karan get the itchies.
No. And I don't want to know how that would work into a plot that could save the day either.
Right.
scratch harder, Karan, scratch harder.
Don't forget, they already turned the idea about Lance parking in a handicap spot at the Space Mall.
Yes, that's true.
So I can easily see them turning down a Poison Oak episode.
No doubt. No doubt. Yeah, this was a fun episode, and I'm glad that we finally had a chance to talk about it.
Like we said, it leads right into they're going to have to face Zarkon, you know, because we saw it at the end of the episode, and it leads right into the next episode.
Dun, dun, dun.
So that's what we'll be doing next time.
Yeah, so, you know, we had a bit of a hiatus from reviewing episodes, and we've now got, what, nine more to cover for season two. And, of course, season three we expect to drop on Netflix sometime later this year. So there's a whole lot more Voltron goodness coming up in future podcast episodes and, of course, from Netflix.
And we're not concerned about whether or not we're going to get these done before season three starts. We really think there's plenty of time here for us to get all these episode reviews in and do more things still.
Oh, yeah. There are plenty of things to talk about in the Voltron world.
Yeah, so we'll be here, and we'll be talking about Voltron, and we hope to see you the next time on...
Let's Voltron!